Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Breaking Muscle Radio. I am your host, Becca Borofsky-Jenkins, and our co-host today is Chet Morjaria. Say hello, Chet.
Hello, this is Chet Morjaria.
All right, so today we actually have three guests with us. This is our first panel discussion because we're going to have a discussion about what is, for most of us, a pretty new aspect of health and fitness, and that is the whole area of epigenetics. I'm going to introduce all three of our guests, and then we're going to go right into a discussion, because I think there's a lot to talk about, and not everyone is necessarily in agreement on it all or fully educated on it all amongst all of you out there. So we want to help everybody to learn about what epigenetics is. So the first of our guests is Shay Robinson. He runs a website called The Nexus of Epigenetics, where he writes about science, history, and politics in regards to epigenetics. He's also known as the epigenetics guy, and he's most likely moments away from finishing his dissertation at this point. Our second guest is Hayden William Cortland. He runs a well-known blog called Science for Fitness. He has an array of degrees in biochemistry, anatomy, physiology, and biomedical sciences, and he's a personal trainer. And our third guest is a regular around Breaking Muscle. That's Kevin Camm. He's one of our resident nutrition experts, and he's written on epigenetics in terms of making the best nutritional choices you can as an individual in those terms. So welcome, Shay, Hayden, and Kevin. Everybody say hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, guys. Really good to have you with us today. So to get us started, I think it'd be really good to define for our audience at various levels what epigenetics actually is. It's probably a relatively new concept for a lot of people, and I also think there's perhaps been a little bit of a lack of clarity on the exact meaning. So whoever wants to jump in first, feel free to give us an explanation or the field of epigenetics.
Okay, this is Shay Robinson. I'll take a stab at it. And actually, this is probably the most difficult part of the whole thing is defining epigenetics concretely. I actually got into this podcast responding to an article on the website about epigenetics and fitness, and I disagreed with how the author had defined epigenetics. I thought his definition was very loose, and I commented that for epigenetics to be meaningful, it probably needed to be the definition needed to be tightened up. And I had a couple posts on my blog about that got some good responses. But even among scientists and epigeneticists, there's a lot of room for disagreement on what exactly epigenetics is. So for me, from my perspective, and this is, there's a very kind of boilerplate, I think, way to introduce epigenetics so epi is the Greek or Latin root meaning over or above, and so epigenetics is over or above genetics, and it's those processes. For me, it's the biological processes that influence gene expression. And tied to me, the important distinguishing factor is tied to manipulation of the genome, expression of the genome. There has to be some kind of biological pathway from the environment, effects from the environment through the epigenome, then affect expression of the gene that way. There's got to be some kind of biological connection. So that's my first stab at that.
All right, Kevin or Hayden, do you have anything you want to add or different thoughts on that?
Just to add a little bit, I think, just to clarify for the audience a little bit, like epigenetics, you know, we've thought for a long time that if we were born with a certain genome, so if our family had a history of obesity or we had a history of certain diseases, it was thought that, oh, well, it's in our genes and there's nothing we can do to change it. I think now understanding that we have a way that our genes actually listen to our internal and external environments and can alter which way that they express themselves, it can actually give us a little bit more direction when it comes to helping out our clients or patients.
So what makes a gene express itself?
So I think this gets at one of the areas of complexity in terms of the idea that the gene can be expressing itself through different types of regulation. So if you take sort of a more contemporary view of the definition of epigenetics, and you sort of go to like the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and you sort of look at what they're looking for in terms of research grants that would be proposed in epigenomics, what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, you have to be doing research where we define epigenetics basically as heritable changes in gene activity and expression that don't actually have a change in the DNA itself. In addition, they allow for long-term alterations in gene expression that are not necessarily heritable. So you have these sort of these two camps here where you're having a heritable change, which is not an actual change in your gene, DNA, but you have a potentially non-heritable change as well. And there's other ways of affecting transcription beyond this, basically just using typical transcription factors, proteins in your body, you know, that are going to go and bind to DNA potentially and just determine whether or not a particular gene is going to be turned into a protein. And these things can be very transient. They can be a result of hormones. And again, as we said, they can be a result of initially external stimuli. But I think really what it comes down to is the change in the gene, is the expression of the gene a very transient effect, or is it something that is a long-term effect? And then even more, is it an actual effect that can be inherited through successive generations? So I think that's where the complexity comes in terms of how it is defined. Because you can have changes in the genes, you know, that are not heritable and that are not long-term in terms of their expression.
For me, because I'm approaching it from the policy, politics side, and that was one of the aspects of epigenetics that was most interesting to me in the context of politics and policy was the heritability. Because for so long, the idea has been we inherit our traits through our genes exclusively. And genetic change, it's just a process of recombination or random mutation. And that's kind of how that worked. And so epigenetics introduces this wrinkle of there actually might be ways that we inherit traits, but not genetically. Our genetic code doesn't change, but we still get these inheritances due to interactions with our environment. And politically, that's very interesting. If there are effects that happen to grandfathers that manifest as diabetes or obesity or heart disease in their grandchildren, without their grandchildren having been exposed to these environmental influences, politically, that's a big issue, and so I think the idea of heritability is definitely an important aspect of epigenetics. So I appreciate that getting brought up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm loving the discussion in terms of the specifics of epigenetics, but I think it'd also be really cool to bring it out slightly wider and give the sort of average fitness enthusiast something to hold on to and to sort of learn about. So how does the average fitness enthusiast, how can they use epigenetics to basically help him or her in what they're doing?
I think this here, it comes all down to their general goals and what they're looking for. Because we all come from a different background, different styles of training are going to affect us different ways, or different nutritional choices are going to affect us different ways. So this is where understanding that there's individual variability with everything that we do. So when they're surfing through their Facebook feed trying to find the best diet for 2015, understanding that what might have worked for somebody else may not necessarily be the best choice for them. And the same goes for physical fitness means. Like, there are some people who are just genetically more apt to be better at basketball and some that are more apt to be better at weightlifting. And basically coming down and finding something that they enjoy is typically going to be something that they're good at as well. So if they try to adopt a low-carb diet for weight loss and realize that they're having a lot of negative effects from it, performance-wise, health-wise, that they might be more apt to eating a higher-carb diet. That low-carb weight loss diet just may not be the right way for them to go about meeting their goals. And there's just so much we haven't uncovered here too. And science is, at this point, is not going to tell us more about our body than what we can kind of figure out from messing around with things all on our own.
I think what's most interesting to me about it is the idea that we're all very different. We all have different genetic backgrounds, and so we're going to respond differently in terms of how we perform for fitness activities, for sports, how we handle nutrition. And there's not much really we can do about that. You know, the genes are the hand you're dealt and the game of cards, as it were. But what's really interesting about epigenetics for me is the idea that you can potentially modulate or alter or change actually how you respond based on the environment. And so obviously the environment can work on you in ways that you don't necessarily want, but physical activity and exercise, there's evidence sort of more and more supporting the idea that that may be a way for you to actually modulate how you are expressing the genes you have. So, yeah, as was said, we don't really have a tremendous amount of data out there, particularly in humans. It's very complicated to do these kinds of studies rigorously, but the work that's done suggests that, you know, by exercising, you may be able to change how your genes are expressed. And so this could be one of those situations where, you know, if you're dealt a set of genes that make you susceptible, let's say, to a disease or, you know, to some sort of ailment, that you might be able potentially to not have as severe a phenotype, as severe a presentation of that disease, if you're basically altering your genome potentially in these epigenetic ways. So there's a potential there for you to sort of work around some deficiencies or, you know, inhibitions you may have. And that's what I think is very exciting about this field in terms of, you know, where it may go, what it may reveal in terms of the potential. But I think people intuitively have a sense that, you know, exercise is quite good and really has a very good benefit. But the idea that you could then potentially could pass it on, some aspect of that, to your offspring is a very exciting and interesting idea, you know, to me personally.
Yeah, it lends go ahead.
Kevin here. I was just going to add to that a little bit. I think we can, you know, get into some dangerous territory with thinking like just exercise. This is where, like, that total holistic approach to health becomes important, where health and disease are placed upon this giant spectrum. And the more we do that's going to enhance positive health, the better off our gene expression is going to be. And I think in a lot of cases, we utilize certain choices, such as exercise, for one, to give us an excuse to be able to take part in poor lifestyle choices in other areas. So, you know, for example, if I go for a long run today, maybe I can, you know, gorge on some poor food choices later. I'm going to wake up early in the morning and deprive myself of sleep to go for a run because, you know, we all know that exercise is good for us. I think the interesting thing about the field of epigenetics is it tells us that we need to make more positive choices and we need to weigh our options. So if we're, you know, really stressed out, we've been having financial problems, family issues, maybe perhaps depriving ourselves of sleep to get up and exercise is not going to be the most appropriate choice for enhancing positive gene expression.
Yeah, I was going to say it really adds a lot of weight to each choice that you make. It's an interesting thing because I think, like you're saying, a lot of people, and I think a lot of our readers are really very active people, very motivated people, and they may think they're making excellent choices when in fact they're actually wearing themselves down in the bigger picture of things. And epigenetics speaks to that bigger picture. And it's also interesting to me in terms of nutrition because, you know, there's kind of a couple different camps out there, and some people are just all about the macros, you know, and they don't care whether you eat a sweet potato or a donut. They're like, it's just the macros. But, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, it seems to me that epigenetics would imply that for some people it could possibly make a really big difference whether it's a sweet potato or a donut.
Yeah, Kevin here again. With the nutrition aspect, it gets really interesting because, you know, we now know that what works for one person might necessarily be completely counterproductive for another person. The amylase gene alone, we have differences in copies between 2 and 15. So that right there just shows us that there's a wide range of the population that's going to do really good on a low-carb diet. There's another range that's going to do really good on a high-carb diet and everything in between. I think with science, we need to keep in mind that everything kind of falls within that inverse U. So the macros probably play a role, but food quality also plays a major role too. And I think as we uncover more and more, it might become easier. Maybe we'll have some type of ability to test our genome so we can figure out where we fall in this bracket. However, it's not even necessary. Like if people would just, you know, try something out, go all in for 30 days, see how you feel, listen to your body. If you know you're trying that low-carb diet and sleep's a little disturbed, you're having a more difficult time recovering from workouts, perhaps add a little bit more to it. But I think the interesting part is we get into these battles on Facebook and social media about which diet is best, and there's never going to be one diet that's going to be best and it's going to be able to blanket the masses just because of these epigenetic variables.
I was going to say, this is actually one of the parts I was looking forward to was Hayden. He was also a commenter on the post on the website that I commented on.
Yep.
Because he had the question in that post, the author was talking about tailoring workout programs using epigenetics for his mm-hmm. clients. And the question I had was, most of what he was talking about didn't seem to actually involve epigenetics so much as phenotype, you know, how the genes are already expressed. And so, and Hayden had actually commented about that too and asked, you know, and so I was curious if, now that Hayden's here, if there have been ways that epigenetics have actually been, you know, a more strict definition of epigenetics, if there are actual methods or actual, I don't know, things that have happened in fitness and exercise that he's come across that are, you know, have been subjected to a more rigorous, I don't know, experimentation or whatever, and have been able to show results, if he knows anything along those lines. Because lately it's mostly been, you know, conjecture, and this could be the way it works. There's been a lot of animal studies. Anyway, I was just curious if Hayden had come across anything.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point because, you know, all the statements are true. The idea that we're all very different and we can't apply blanket approaches to training or nutrition to people. But if you don't qualify that, the underlying reasons for that could purely be genetics. We're all very different in how we respond based on our genetics. So the idea for epigenetics is to say, yes, we have that variability, but we need to move beyond that and say, is there another level of regulation that is not encoded in the DNA? You know, and this is where it gets tricky. And if you try to use, you know, epigenetics and you start looking at the literature or what has been studied with respect to that, it's pretty scant with respect to humans. And then there's a lot of reasons behind this. And what it is it's basically, with the literature, it's been this buildup where it's easier to recognize it in the smaller animal models, like in mice and rodents, where, you know, you can have progeny in a fairly quick period of time and see the offspring and see how they manifest traits. And they've isolated sort of a lot of the molecular components of this, looking at how DNA gets methyl groups added and histones get deacetylated. So these are sort of the major players in how epigenetic regulation seems to work. We have evidence of it, you know, being heritable in these small animal models. But then what happens when we go to humans, we try to do a study, you know, well, humans have a very long lifespan, there's ethical issues, you know, you can't easily do a study. Then if you try to say, well, we're concerned about does exercise or nutrition or sleep
have epigenetic effects, you have to do experiments where you control all of these factors for all the people in your study. So they all have to be doing the same type of training. They ideally have to have the same type of background history of training to be able to try to narrow these variables down and see an effect. And so we can't really do that very well. So the studies, basically, if you look what's out there, they have studies where they'll apply some sort of diet program or apply a training regimen and look at the markers we know to be associated with epigenetics based on the animals. So we'll look to see, is the methylation status changing on the DNA? Are the histones being deacetylated? And we do see those changes. So the changes that appear in animal models, where we see it in much more detail, we do see some of those changes in human studies when we apply some sort of effect, diet or exercise or and so forth. But actually making the link as to, is it heritable? What specifically are those changes doing? Which genes are they affecting? Are those genes being upregulated or downregulated? That's where it's really tough, because it's so difficult to handle the variability that is the human population. So it's really, I don't see right now a way for us to directly apply, pure sort of epigenetics in terms of tailoring workouts and diets. I just feel like it's still very young in terms of what we understand. So that's my take.
Yeah, this is Shay. That's how it also seems to me is there are some really good animal studies, and then there are some correlational studies in humans that incorporate the information being generated by the animal studies. But, for all the reasons you said, it just, at this point, it's all... And again, I love epigenetics. I love the topic, and I tend to err on the side of enthusiasm. I think a lot of this stuff is very, makes a lot of sense. But I also need to remind myself to tread lightly and to kind of restrain myself because although these studies are very suggestive, and I would say. Very, I don't know. They seem good to me. But again, most of it is for humans is correlational and not
right.
And we can't pinpoint the specific variables. But again, by the same token, I think there is the weight of evidence is growing just through these correlations that they're able to identify the epigenetic pathways. In these animal studies, and then identify the same, and those same pathways can be identified in humans, and then they see the same kinds of changes measured from before and after. And so I think it's valid to start drawing inferences, but I still think caution is required, even though, like I said, I'm very enthusiastic about it, and so
yeah.
I like to run with it.
So I have a question. Obviously, when they're doing this research, they're narrowing the scope down, and I think it would be useful for our audience to kind of have a singular example of what's possible. So I don't know if any of you can give an example of a specific gene that might be tested and what the options are. Like if there's four different ways for it to express itself, what is an example of one gene and the different things that might happen?
This is Shay again. If I could, probably the prototypical one is the AGOUTI gene, the AGOUTI gene.
Yep.
And there are a breed of mice, AGOUTI mice, that they are used in laboratories, and they breed rapidly. There's all sorts of benefits to using this kind of mouse. And when the mice are healthy. And they breed, so they can breed and be genetically identical also. And so you get all these sets of basically twins. Mm-hmm. And then you can do all sorts of manipulations from there. And so when these mice are healthy, they have brown coats and they are thin and they just have good health profiles. When they're unhealthy, they are obese, they have white coats. Anyway, they're unhealthy. And so... In epigenetic studies, these AGOUTI mice have been used focusing on this agouti gene, the expression of this agouti gene, which humans also have. And it also seems to perform many of the same functions or related to many of the same functions in humans as it is in these mice. So there's the correlation there. And so in these mice studies, they've done a couple of different ways, manipulated the methylation of the agouti gene. One way is through diet, and so they have fed mother mice either a high folic, I think folic acid has been the main ingredient, either diets high in folic acid or low in folic acid, and then that has methylated or not methylated this agouti gene. And then you get either if they were given, and I always get this, either if they were given a diet high in folic acid, which I think is, so basically green vegetables, strawberries, things like that. Then the children of the mice who were given this diet, their genes, their agouti genes are methylated, and they were born healthy. And then the offspring of the rats the mice who weren't given this diet, they were born unhealthy. So they would, the healthy mice would have this, were thin with a brown coat, et cetera. But then what they also found was that the daughters of the mice, so the granddaughters of the original mice, they were also born with these healthy profiles, kind of regardless of the diet that their mothers were given. So if their grandmother was fed this specific kind of diet, the granddaughters would actually be born healthy, kind of regardless. And then there's also a maternal care track of those experiments where mothers who licked their daughters a lot is basically rat or mice care. That's how they cared for the young. The mothers who licked their daughters a lot, the granddaughters were actually born with healthy profiles, regardless of whether their mothers licked them or not. And so there's this transgenerational inheritance aspect of this. So either it's been linked to diet and also to maternal care. So does that fit the bill?
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating.
That is, yes. So I was just about to say exactly the same thing. Completely fascinating and also really useful to put it into the context of an example. And just to carry on down that example route and even to bring it out to an example which our listeners may have heard of or seen in the news is the work done on Huntington's disease. It'd be great if one or more of you could provide a summary of the research done on Huntington's disease and what it is to date, basically.
Basically, Huntington's disease, it's Kevin here. Huntington's disease, it's a rare genetic disorder of the Huntington genome. It's a really fascinating disease because, for one, the survival benefit of it, the people with this gene tend to reproduce almost twice as often as the rest of the population. And symptoms don't seem to set in until about 35 to 50 years of age, where the disease just kind of takes over and does a substantial amount of damage. Neurodegeneration occurs, and the patients seem to waste away very quickly. The other interesting part, too, is the onset of symptoms, the wide range of it. In other countries, some countries don't have an onset of symptoms until they're over 50 years of age. There's been documented research of, you know, patients with the gene never even showing symptoms until old age and lived out a full life. I think when it comes to the gene, the negative gene expression for the Huntington's gene, I think what really leads us down the path for that gene expressing itself is the increased oxidation that we undergo, so like stress itself. In Huntington's disease, our circadian rhythms, they just show to be really out of whack, and altered circadian rhythm and increased oxidative stress have actually been shown to lead to the onset of the symptoms in Huntington's disease. which becomes really important for us to understand. You know, if we are diagnosed or we're told that we have the specific gene, there may actually be options for us to potentially try to control this gene expression to at least the later end of that age spectrum. You know, there's been a lot of good research, too, showing, like, increases in tissue transglutaminase has led to an onset of symptoms, which would lead us right back to the oxidation required there. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with Dr. Walz's research for multiple sclerosis, but I think a lot of the same principles that she applies nutritionally, I think, could have positive impacts on Huntington's disease as well. Just eating a really high nutrient-dense diet is going to give us those antioxidants and really help us battle oxidative stress. Another piece of it, too, is the hormone glutathione, which is one of our major antioxidants. And it tends to become people with Huntington's disease tend to have really low levels of glutathione once they hit the onset of symptoms. So there might be a potential for glutathione supplementation that may be able to help battle some of that oxidative stress in hopes of at least prolonging the symptoms of the disease to keep it as simple as possible and short. I don't know if you guys have any other things you'd like to add into that.
I'm not as familiar with the Huntington's side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you made very good points. You know, it's an interesting question in terms of, I mean, it's clearly a genetic disorder, but there's evidence to support that it can be regulated either for good or for bad based on epigenetic mechanisms. So, again, traditionally the idea of changes in methylation status of the DNA of the genes in question can affect how those genes are expressed and either aggravate or improve basically, you know, how the disease presents itself. And so, and that's a very good question as to whether or not those modalities you mentioned are ways to alleviate the disease. And I think that's one of the gaps we have is we tend to understand to some extent that the epigenetic changes come from these kinds of modifications of the gene, methyl groups, acetylation to the histones, but we don't know how those changes really come about necessarily and to what extent they are resulting from changes in sleep pattern or changes in free radicals from diet and that whole sort of thing. So that link there is sort of just not as clear as it needs to be. And these may be very important ways for us to improve these disease outcomes if we actually can at some point link the two, you know, link diet, activity, sleep to the specific epigenetic regulation of the gene.
So some of the other research I've read, like we talked about Huntington's, I've seen research specifically on type 2 diabetes, which then also ties into the whole obesity epidemic. So can the same things we're learning from Huntington's be applied generally to how type 2 diabetes and obesity manifest?
Kevin here again. I definitely think, you know, research is leading there. It's still relatively new. I've seen some current research that's been looking at the gene that modulates leptin in obesity in mice. Again, who knows how much that this transfers over to human subjects. But it looks like, you know, some of the decisions that, you know, our parents and our grandparents are making are definitely altering this gene in utero for, you know, upcoming generations. And where there's leptin dysfunction, there's insulin dysfunction. So it makes sense. And it could begin to explain why we're starting to see type 2 diabetes being diagnosed earlier and earlier in life.
Yeah, both the Huntington discussion and then this getting into obesity and diabetes bring up the developmental window, aspect of developmental windows, I think. And in humans, so some of the big studies in epigenetics, and again, they're correlational, but have been done with the Dutch hunger winter. And then there's a province in Sweden, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it in Swedish, but Overkalix, the Overkalix studies, where they have So the Dutch Hunger Winter in 1944-1945, with the Nazi occupation of Holland, there was a famine in the Netherlands during this time, and so they have tracked people who were alive during that time and then looked at their health over time and then the health of their children over time and then the health of their, starting with the health of their grandchildren over time. And then with the Over Kalix studies, it's this province in Sweden, and they have gone back to the 1800s and looked at crop records and then been able to establish, okay, so during this time period, there was a lack of food. During these periods, there is prosperity. And then they've looked at the health profiles of those people and then, again, traced it transgenerationally and tried to identify, so is there any connection, is there a relation between environmental conditions, you know, at this point in time, and then one generation, two generations, three generations, and so on. And so they've been able to uncover there are these fairly strong correlations between health outcomes and conditions of, you know, these environmental conditions of parents and grandparents. And the excuse me. The what's interesting about that is then a lot of it depends, especially with the Dutch Hunger Winter studies, a lot of it has depended if a child was in utero during this famine. There are all sorts of correlations, both positive and negative correlations with health outcomes later versus if the child was prepubescent. Then being prepubescent during this hunger winter was associated with all of these, and again, this is another thing that I always flip, was correlated with, I think, increased risk for diabetes. But if you were in utero during that same time, it was actually correlated with decreased risk for diabetes. And so depending, again, to these developmental windows, depending on what stage in development you were during these environmental conditions, and they've linked these to epigenetic markers. Throw that in. That's an important part of it. They've linked these to epigenetic markers. And so depending on what developmental stage you were at this time, depending on how these epigenetic markers were manifest, and then they're also correlated with these health outcomes. Different kinds of cancers, diabetes, obesity, things like that.
So when we see these kinds of results, what it does is just it gives more support for the idea that an epigenetic effect is a major player in terms of how diseases can present themselves. And, you know, so when, you know, initially a lot of time is spent, it's still spent, trying to comb through the genome and try to understand, you know, different variations in genes and single nucleotide variations that might be contributing to disease, and the research has not been as productive as scientists, I think, originally wanted. And that sort of made many of them think, well, maybe there's something sort of beyond just the actual genetic code of your genes that's, you know, running the show. And then we have these studies come along like this. It just gives further support for the idea that, you know, well, yeah, it may be a bit bigger than just our genetics. You know, the interplay between the two is potentially very important.
So that, you know, on a practical level, could kind of be overwhelming. Like, say, for example, my parents ate a horrible diet, and my grandparents ate a horrible diet, and none of them exercised. Am I just screwed, or what can I do about that?
Kevin here. The good news is that because of epigenetics and what we're talking about, you're definitely not screwed. Even though, like, you know, we were talking about the research and how it's hard to perform it on humans, the good thing is that, you know, if you work with a good healthcare practitioner, they should have a way to be able to track data. You know, they come in, you come in, they do a good assessment of you. They can kind of figure out where you currently are. And we can keep track of stuff to make sure that everything's moving in the right direction. And if that's happening, you know, what we're doing is obviously working. We don't need hardcore scientific research to let us know that. So there is definitely hope, and I've seen numerous clients in that same boat who have definitely reversed their tides for the better.
All right, cool.
This is Shay. That's actually one of the focuses of my dissertation is the narratives that come out of genetics and epigenetics. And I look at those in terms of obesity in particular. And so by narrative, I mean what are the stories that are told from the point of view of genetics and then the point of view of epigenetics. And so one of the things I look at is reports of genetics or obesity reports in like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And what aspects do they emphasize? Do these reports on obesity emphasize? And so genetics, one of the ways that genetics is talked about is, again, the simplistic, you have a gene for this. And so and it's misleading to talk about it that way, but in these popular media outlets, that's a lot of how it's talked about is just how determinative genes are. And so that's what I've been interested in with epigenetics is, so how is epigenetics talked about in those terms? And so, because there's a couple ways it could go, like you were saying, Becca, it could sound very like you're screwed because your grandparents started smoking when they were 9 or whatever.
Right.
And so you're just, but then the other side of that also is, well, actually it suggests a lot of plasticity. And so it, you know, it kind of gives and takes away at the same time. And that's what I'm interested in from a policy, political science point of view is which of those narratives is going to eventually win out. But at this point, the good news is, I would say at this point, there's a lot of suggestive evidence. And I like I said, I'm an optimist. And so I think, yeah, this suggests that we have more control, we have more influence on this than just the purely genetic perspective. So that's my, I'm choosing the positive on this one.
Yeah, it's interesting to me when you start looking at the social aspects and the political aspects, because I know we've written about this before on our site, kind of the urban food deserts where you see like inner cities where fresh foods aren't easily available and junk food is the predominant thing. And then you see statistics that show certain populations are more susceptible to diabetes and obesity and other diseases. Are we basically capitalizing accidentally on people's genetics and epigenetics by not providing them that good food? Like there's a strange kind of social responsibility that seems like we're failing on.
That's the most interesting part of epigenetics is the how its political and social implications and uses, because you can spin anything anyway. And so, I'm kind of interested in that. That's my main focus too, is the politics of it. So who gets the credit, who gets the blame, is basically kind of what politics resolves down to. And then epigenetics is an interesting new player in that, because depending on how you talk about it, you can blame the environment, or you can blame, you know, like the individual anyway. So, but it's still so new that the narrative is in flux, and that's what I'm trying to start pinning down is how is the narrative developing. So I didn't really answer your question. I just threw my two bits in, I guess.
Yeah, no, that works. That totally works. I mean, I guess for some of these questions, there really is no answer. It's like you said, like choosing a narrative. Yeah, just still a lot of exploration happening, right?
Right.
I think the real overriding complexity of it is that we can't really separate out fully, you know, if what the effect actually is. Is it genetics or is it epigenetics for a given condition, disease, and so forth? I think, you know, certainly you can work with a client or patient and see them making steady progress, but you don't really know what exactly is, you know, specifically, biologically, you know, contributing to that process. You know, and I think that the science that we have to date suggests that it is a very complex interaction between their genetics and their epigenetics. You know, the genetics in and of itself is much more complicated than we thought it was. Obviously, we know people have different versions of genes. You get different copies and versions from your parents. But, you know, over the years, we've discovered that, you know, if you have a different version of another gene that's separate, it can affect how, you know, a given gene is actually acting and expressing in your body. So different genes affect how other genes are expressed. And then on top of that, you have to apply, you know, what we're now sort of been talking about, this idea of epigenetics as well. You know, so just the level of interaction is pretty substantial trying to keep track of this. This is one of the problems that science suffers with, is that you can't really take things in individual pieces and study them, because in pretty much in every case, everything depends on something else. You know, it doesn't work. You don't work in isolation.
Yeah, fine.
You know, and you just, so that's one of the failings of science. But, you know, the upside is that more and more scientists these days are moving towards integrative approaches. They're reaching out. You know, they're working with scientists in other fields. They're working with clinicians. They're trying to add more levels of complexity to the studies they do to try to get a more, you know, whole or total view of what's going on. But in terms of, you know, assessing it from, you know, an individual patient, it's tough. It's sort of like, you know, you really have the whole thing going on simultaneously, you know, when you're trying to take it for what it is.
Yeah, I find it interesting the discussion's moving now similar. We've discussed a lot of the positive aspects of epigenetics, and now we're starting to talk about the challenges and the concerns, and you were just talking there about cause and effect as well, and, you know, the problems of science, I guess. And this is just pulled from your website, Shay, and you said, epigenetics challenges the conventional philosophical separations between the internal and external, so human and nature, past and present, and cause and effect. So I'd like to continue that discussion and ask you, all of you, what aspects of epigenetics cause you concern personally? I mean, I know there's a whole philosophical, ethical conundrum going on there, as we talked about with the research as well.
Kevin here. Just getting back to the Huntington's gene thing, because it is it's a very sad disease once symptoms set in. You know, there's been talk about trying to remove genes from the gene pool. And I think without fully understanding the entire impact that some of these decisions might have, I think it's frightening. The fact that there's a strong survival benefit to that gene, that symptoms don't start to show themselves till post-reproductive age, and that they're reproducing twice as much as the general population, it scares me to think that removing this gene might actually have a lot of negative long-term implications to it. So I think jumping to conclusions about epigenetics before we truly, fully understand the complexity of the human gene system, it's frightening.
Yeah, I would kind of go along with that also. I have written a couple posts and then written a couple papers, too, about this, because one of the things, the aspects of epigenetics that is interesting is, in many ways, it's just like genetic engineering. Except genetic engineering is undertaken intentionally under very controlled conditions and to achieve specific purposes, whereas epigenetics, until now and probably for the foreseeable future, it's these environmental influences, and so it has effects like genetic engineering, but without any of the intentionality or control. And so the fears that the justifiable fears that come from the possibility for genetic engineering, coupled with the realization that we have actually always been engineering our genome epigenetically, but without knowing it, is sobering, I guess.
Yeah. What do you see as so we've kind of talked about the frightening aspects of it. What do you see as the most positive possible outcomes in the near future?
Kevin, again, I think, you know, like others have said, I err on the side of positivity when I'm looking at epigenetics. I think we can, you know, start to understand diseases and what causes the negative gene expression, and we may be able to, choose certain interventions that will allow us to have a much higher prevalence to kind of push these diseases out. So like type 2 diabetes we talked about, if we truly understand what's causing those genes to express themselves, we can kind of figure out ways that we can avoid that from happening. And the same can be said about a number of other diseases.
I think what's most exciting for me is the idea that, you know, if we understand more about genetics, what it's basically going to do is it's going to give weight to the ideas that we've been talking about here, that your environment, whatever that may be, in terms of training, diet, you know, sleep, these sort of external factors, the idea that these may have a very, very important role in your health and in modulating your genome, I think is something that is just very underappreciated in the scientific community. I think it's underappreciated in just, you know, a lot of people's daily lives, how they go about living. And I think one of the benefits of science is that if this sort of matured as a field and we actually had a lot more than just sort of association studies and studies that pointed more towards causality, I think we'd get people sort of realizing the importance of this, you know, that they have some control, or they have to consider things that are going on outside of them, perhaps just as much as, you know, the hand they were dealt genetically.
Yeah, I would just reinforce those. To me, the exciting part of it and the positive part of it is it does seem to grant us more ability than we previously thought possible in terms of recognizing the influence of the environment and then doing something that we can do something about those. I think this is one of the things I look at in my academic work. There's a lot of fatalism in a way associated with genetics. If you have these genes, then, you know, that's what you've got and you can't change them. And epigenetics is interesting in the way that it opens that up and says, okay, you have these genes and they're expressing this way, but maybe we can do something with that. So, like I said, I generally try to go for the positive on this.
So to continue that positivity then and to advance the field of epigenetics, which aspects do you feel require more research and will take epigenetics to the next level?
This is Shay. One interesting thing, I have a couple of posts on my blog about this also, is, and I can't remember who talked about it before, but the big thing with genetics and genomics has been sequencing. If we can establish the sequence of the gene, so the C's, the A's, the T's, and the G's, what the sequence that those are in, that will tell us all we need to know. But what's interesting and how this ties back in epigenetics is the actual, because that's the linear structure of the gene, of the genome, the, you know, C-A-T-T-T-A-C-T-G or whatever it is. But the DNA is a three-dimensional shape form. And it twists and bends. It's very, very three-dimensional. And epigenetics actually has a lot to do with the 3D structure of the genome, of DNA. And so DNA can, if it's acetylated or methylated in certain parts, it will relax and open up. And so parts of the genome that were previously not exposed will then be exposed, and then those can be methylated or acetylated themselves. And so you can get all sorts of, and just the 3D structure of itself, you can get genes or sequences that are separated, you know, by long distances, relatively speaking, but because of 3D structure, they're actually folded and next to each other, and that affects the expression of each other also. But you wouldn't be able to tell that just using the gene sequence. It takes considerations of this three-dimensional structure, and again, epigenetics seems to be an important factor in why DNA is wrapped the way it is. And it can also be manipulated through epigenetics. And so that, I think, like I said, I have a couple of posts on my blog about this, that that is a very important consideration that I think is just now starting to get some traction, that it's not just sequence, it's structure also that is important in genetic type studies. And so to me, it doesn't make any sense to separate genomics from epigenomics, because sequence will tell you one thing, but then the structure is also a very important factor.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point you made. Very good.
Yeah, it's like every time I think I start understanding one level, it turns out there's another dimension. Kevin or Hayden, what would you like to see researched more?
Kevin here. I think trying to, understand, I think it gets really, really dodgy when we start thinking of where the research needs to go with this. I get back to talking about my biggest fear with it, because I feel all it's going to take is, like, once we have that general idea, instead of just, double checking and triple checking, that we're literally going to be like jumping the boat, and I fear we're going
to. Kevin doesn't seem to be a fan of science.
I'm a huge fan of science, but it's when science meets governmental policies that it begins to worry me a bit.
Yeah,
I feel like one of the things that epigenetics might bring about too is if we understand how to stop diseases without, the intervention of pharmaceutical medications and stuff, that there's going to be commercial impacts, here in the United States, where pharmaceutical companies are such a big part of our economic structure. In an ideal world, I would like to see, epigenetic research go towards, understanding the complexities of the human genome and, what causes those genes to express themselves, what ways we can avoid it, and ultimately, predicting the future upon that gene expression. So before we remove it or we try to alter it, we, understand the survival benefit of it and understand, it's maybe make more of a hypothesis on what it's going to bring about for future generations, whether it's going to be negative or positive.
All right, Hayden, what about you? What would you like to see for the future of epigenetics?
Yeah, I agree with all that's been said so far. I think definitely, starting small, a lot of the studies that come out, don't actually even, isolate the genes or families of genes that are actually being affected by these epigenetic modifications. But there's a new paper that came out, Lindholm and others, and, they saw an effect with exercise, but they didn't go and isolate the gene, so we don't really have a good grasp of just the linear one-dimensional effects, let alone, the more three-dimensional effects. So I think just basic understanding of, what genes are being affected is important. But, I'm a huge advocate for this. I talk about it on my website all the time. It's just trying to make studies that are just, more specific, where you sort of dial in the number of variables, look at very specific groups of individuals, separate out women from men, don't lump them together, try to keep age groups similar, do the best you can in terms of the type of exercise stimulus or the diet you're administering, really just, I think that's something we need to improve across the board in all the kinds of scientific studies that we do in, health and nutrition and fitness. There's a lot of variability, which is making it difficult to really see what's going on in terms of the science of it, So improving all that, I think, would go a long way towards understanding the epigenetics as well.
Yeah, well, we're going to start wrapping up, but thank you all for being here. I think, I think the word epigenetics gets thrown a lot around in the media right now as kind of a trendy phrase, and so it's really nice to actually understand the science of it more. I personally feel a lot more educated on it. I also feel a lot more aware of what I don't know about it and what we all don't know about it. So it's fascinating. And I'd love to do this with you guys again in the future as more and more research comes out and we can keep talking about different aspects of it. But thank you for enlightening us on this. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to help us all learn more about this whole topic.
You bet.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd like to say thank you to each of you too, Shay, Hayden, and Kevin. And I know something that I want to do right now is go back and look at all of your websites again, and look up all the stuff that you've just been talking about, the research and the papers that you've written. So it'd be really cool if you could give a quick shout out to your websites and anything else relevant as well.
Kevin, here, my website's geneticpotentialnutrition.com.
This is Shay. My website's called The Nexus of Epigenetics. It's at epigeneticsguide.wordpress.com. And then I also am on Twitter as epigeneticsguy.
And I'm Hayden. My website is Science for Fitness, scienceforfitness.com. And all my other contacts is on there for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
All right. Everybody has an assignment to go read more for their homework now. I might drink some more caffeine first, though. All right. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And for all of you out there listening, this is Breaking Muscle Radio, and we hope to have you back for many more episodes. Thank you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo, and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.